This is a waste of bandwidth, this zombie takeout. Oh, here it goes.
Hello, and welcome to episode 476 of Zombie Takeout. The B-Movie and Cult Movie Show. I'm John.
And hello, I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, we've got some listeners submitted from Bodo. First off, he let us know that his health is doing better, his blood pressure is down. I'm just going to give this information instead of putting the emails, voicemails in. He's doing better in general.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you, man.
He had some issues listening to the show on the app. I'm assuming you mean iTunes. Yeah, the Zombie Takeout feed is a little iffy. For some reason, it has a tendency not to catch up. There's another feed for the John and Scotto show. It has both shows on it, as all of our shows on it. That's much more reliable. Bodo, I will message you with this probably before you even hear this in the episode. But
oh, it's anyway, like a time warp.
Yeah. Also, we were talking about the TNG reunion on Picard next season a couple episodes ago, and he chimed in to point out that Will Wheaton's not included.
He's probably told to shut up.
Well, he hosts the Ready Room on their YouTube channel, and I think it's on CBS All Access as well, or Paramount Plus now. So he does like the after show for all of the Star Trek shows, but he's not being included. It's got to be a he's still under contract with Star Trek, with, you know, CBS, whatever. He's still under that contract, so it's got to be just a scheduling issue.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Maybe there could be something between him and someone on the show, because, I mean, I don't think he was ever in the TNG movies, right?
Barely. I think he's at the beginning of the last of the one we're doing next, Nemesis.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure he's at the start of that one. But I know he gets along real well with Frakes and Stewart and Spiner. I don't know about everybody else, but he seems like he gets along well with everybody.
Okay.
So. And finally, onto this week's movie, which is from 2017, Gilbert. This is our Gilbert Gottfried tribute, of course. He passed away last week, was it?
Yeah, I think it was. It was just like a week ago.
Yeah, actually, I think it was last Tuesday, so we couldn't quite get it in last week.
Yeah.
And of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Shouting. Turns out you can make a career out of it.
Also brought to you by Floss. Try some on your next date with that special someone. All right, so they begin pretty much early on in his life with his sisters, his home life. Actually, they begin with an appearance on the Howard Stern show. Mm. I did not realize he went back as far on Stern as he did. Like, they didn't mention this in the doc, but he goes all the way back to, like, 87 with them.
That makes sense, because that's, I think, like, 85, 86 is when he started getting, like, mainstream popularity.
Right. And that was the other weird thing. They really didn't get into... There's, like, a missing portion of his life here, you know. For like, he goes from a stand-up comedian in like the late 70s to, you know, Beverly Hills Cop in 87. Well,
and that was the thing. That was 87?
Yeah,
I thought that was way earlier.
Well, this is the second Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, okay.
First one.
All right, because that was really his big, you know, push into the public.
Right. I mean, he kind of had some others that led him to that,
right.
But this movie completely skips over that for some reason.
Yeah.
It more focuses on his personal life and his
Structural issues with the movie.
And, yeah, I mean, considering that his professional, story is kind of, like, they didn't have to go into great detail about it, but, I mean, they were still, like, he was an SNL character, cast member. He didn't mention it all. The only way you know that is that they had Piscopo in there.
Right.
And which I didn't realize Piscopo was part of that disaster SNL 80 as well. The cursed season. It really was.
He kind of crossed over. He was the holdover from the Murphy years.
Well, Murphy started then too. but he started like later in the season. It
was, this is before Murphy.
Yeah, this is the cursed SNL 80, and I call it cursed. I was looking at it in detail to see they made like several John Lennon jokes, like leading up. Like Charles Rocket was doing some sort of goofy thing where he's walking around the Dakota in front of the Dakota, interviewing people about John. And I think it was like a week or two later he gets shot and killed.
This is the cast that nobody remembers, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Charles Rocket.
Yeah.
And a lot of other, and Gilbert, of course.
Right.
But anyway, so it focuses a lot on his family, and the announcement is that he's getting married on the Howard Stern, well, not on the Howard Stern Show, but he announces on the Howard Stern Show that he's getting married. And of course, at this point, Stern knew him for like 20 years about and had no idea that he'd been seeing someone for like a decade and that, that he was going to get married.
He was intensely private.
Yeah, until this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of this stuff that people did not know that were even close to him, you know, in the field until this movie came out. It busted that open.
Wow.
So, and there's his sisters. One of them they really didn't get into too much, but one of them is like this amazing photographer, gospel singer, even though she's Jewish. I didn't pick up on that part.
Notice the photography. I completely missed the gospel singing.
Yes, she would go down to this church, and she was like singing. I mean, she's like a kick-ass singer.
Yeah.
And then, and unfortunately, she passed as they were putting this together in the end. But
they cover her cancer treatment briefly.
Yeah, they cover her cancer treatment, and they cover his family, sort of his family history, really going back to his grandparents and his relationship with his father. And then the other part, of course, is his because he goes through so many different types of careers, or phases of his career, you know, from the part they skipped over to you know, the two we mentioned before, and then where he starts, you know, getting stuff. They didn't even left out Up All Night, which is kind of weird because he was kind of really famous for that.
They didn't mention it all because, again, that's another. I pulled one of my perspective intros from the trailer, a line that didn't make it into the movie. There was a mention of Up All Night in the trailer.
Yeah.
That apparently didn't make it into the movie.
You know, I was kind of waiting for it because, I mean...
I think that's how I first heard about him.
Of course. It's how a lot of people first heard about him. He really got his mainstream, and they didn't, like... This is something else not mentioned in the film. His real big mainstream appearance was actually a guest stint on The Cosby Show.
Oh.
So
I could see cutting at The Cosby Show.
But that was huge for his career. Yeah. I mean, he did SNL 80, and like I said, that was cursed. Mm-hmm. Like, people getting fired in the middle of, like, Weekend Update, and people getting fired mid-season, and then...
Charles Rocket was a comedic genius, and that season shot his career in the foot.
And yeah, it might not necessarily have been his fault. It was just... It was NBC and the producers, and they just... They really were flailing. You know, Dick Ebersol gets brought in like mid-season, you know. And then just as he's brought in, there's a writer's strike. And they lose like half the season after that. I mean, it was cursed.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. It's like that photo of Gilbert with Louis Anderson and Norm MacDonald and Bob Saget. Or I don't think the MacDonald.
Yeah, no, MacDonald wasn't it. It was Gilbert, Louis, and Bob. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was Michael Ian Black that said that camera was cursed.
Mm-hmm.
So the phase they go into here after this, he gets Disney money. Which, of course, like, that's everything was like, and then he made it to this level, and you're just like, whoa. And then he's kind of down and out.
The dirtiest comedian since Carlin is a Disney staple.
You know, his wife sounded serious that he was a clean act.
I wasn't sure about that. Okay, that was a joke.
She sounded very serious about it, though, didn't she?
Yeah, I thought it was just true.
And I was kind of like, really? I can't believe. But of course,
that was my learn until the end of toward the end of the movie.
The giant thing that happened, of course, was the Hugh Hefner roast. And the Hugh Hefner roast, I didn't realize it was that close to 9/11. Mm-hmm. I knew it was near 9/11. I think, you know, it makes sense because I think it was actually aired in October after 9/11. So it was within weeks of it, mm-hmm. if not days. And it was really strange. And Gilbert is the one who made the joke that was too soon.
Yeah.
But of course, the funny thing is, instead of being like, oh, you know, sorry about that, guys.
Yeah.
He launches in.
Yeah. To the aristocrats.
The aristocrats joke, which was not known outside of comedic circles before that time.
We got to do that movie.
I kind of thought we were going to do that as his tribute, but this is probably better.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's only in it for like a little bit. But that joke is online. And when I say that joke, it goes on for well over 20 minutes.
Well, that's the whole point of the aristocrats.
And think about it, though. It's supposed to be a taping for Comedy Central.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he's only got so much time in his segment.
And it's TV show. I mean, Comedy Central wasn't exactly broadcast, but they had their standards.
And I mean, it's, you know, incest and bestiality and just this whole, but the way he tells it when you listen to it online, just the whole, like, hey, did you miss anything? Because I could start again if you want to, you know. And of course, I can't do Gilbert's voice justice, but, you know,
All of the issues I have with the film, it did give me an appreciation for Gilbert that I didn't have previously.
And there's so much they missed. I mean, well, yeah, they did a little bit of his award show appearances, too, which came before that, where he would just, he had the reputation of being a guy who just, like, fucking would pull the camera out and just, mm-hmm. you know, like.
Yeah.
There was one that I have not yet defined, but I remember it where he, you know, when the Oscars bring someone out mm-hmm. to introduce the person right. to do the next scene. They had him do that, and he went on this tirade for I don't know how long about how stupid it was that he was introducing somebody mm-hmm. to introduce somebody.
Right.
And just completely off the cuff.
See that, Chris Rock? Gilbert Gottfried didn't even get slapped.
Well, that leads to the next, shall we say, seismic event in his career.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to make the too soon edgelord jokes in like a club amongst your friends.
There is a difference. And but I even think there is a significant difference between the 9/11 joke and the Japan joke.
Yeah.
The 9/11 joke and really his better, really fucking edgy stuff, he's really making fun of himself.
Yeah.
With the 9/11 stuff, he was kind of punching down. Even the with the Japan stuff, rather. With the 9/11 joke, he was the one on the plane.
Right.
You know, he was kind of making the joke about himself. I'll get to it later, but the Catherine Zeta-Jones jokes.
Yes.
That was about him, and it wasn't belittling the condition.
Right. Right.
You know, with the Japan jokes, he kind of mocked the victims.
Yeah, and like, but the bad thing about it was because it's done on Twitter, there's fucking people in Japan with Twitter.
Yeah, that's the problem. I have this much later in my notes, but the thing that people talk about, you know, you can't joke anymore. What you have to understand is that if you're on the internet, the audience is a fuckload bigger.
Right.
You're not in the club.
Right. I mean, I think those jokes at a club.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a problem with that.
No.
Yeah, but when you're on Twitter, just keep in mind, there could have been somebody, there could have been numerous people who lost their families, mm-hmm. everything, you know, and they're just like, oh, you know, I'll kick back and see, you know, what's going on and try to take my mind.
Right.
Oh, well, that really sucks. So, I mean, you're laughing at the person who's lost everything already. And so, of course, that lost his big, you know, pitchman thing, which,
Ah, fuck.
I mean, understandable, you know,
Yeah.
that's not the thing they're into. Although they did, I didn't they hire him after he made the 9/11 joke?
Yeah.
Now, the difference is, of course, the 9/11 joke didn't make air. That is
Right.
something that got, you know, the video quality on YouTube is like iffy. Yeah, in the movie, even the clip they use is iffy because it's not an official Comedy Central release, as far as I know.
And anyone who wants to deny the existence of that joke, or who wanted to at that time, could easily do so.
Yeah.
You know, in favor of a paycheck that, you know, Gottfried would have gotten them. You know, when the Twitter thing happened, that was just all over the place, and they couldn't deny it.
Right. So they go into his family life, and we can just say hilarity ensued.
If he had made those exact same jokes in a club and the clip got on YouTube, Affleck could have said, "We didn't say it,"
Yeah.
and kept, you know, getting the paycheck from him.
Right.
I was shocked that his stand-up career went back to the 70s.
Me too. He's 15.
I.
He was 15 when his sisters were like, he's so funny. Let's bring him to one of these comedy clubs with the open mics and just throw him on stage. And yeah, he just did his thing. And I love the explanation as to why he shouts. Well, I think it's a theory. I forget. I think it was Jeffrey Ross that had come up with it, with talking about how his voice needed to go up as people were just booing and
Yeah,
heckling
he
him.
was shouting. I think it was David Tell.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
He came from, you know, shouting over the heckling crowd.
Because, well, the one thing you do learn about him from this is he really didn't give a fuck if the audience liked him or
No, no.
not. It was a
And
lot more about performance art than being an entertainer.
right. Yeah, he was kind of in that Andy Kaufman school.
Definitely. I saw him live myself in the early 2000s in Lakewood, New Jersey. I think it was like, it used to be called the Castle. It was where like my junior prom was, and my sister's wedding reception was there. Not at the same time, of course, that would have been weird, but very close to each other, actually. And yeah, he performed there, so it was a real strange, you know, like dining hall kind of setting. And I swear the first 20 minutes of his bit, of his routine, was just him taking a napkin and doing something with that napkin.
Yeah, he did his share of prop comedy.
I don't think he even said a word for like the first 5 to 10 minutes after he walked out. He just took a napkin and he starts like fucking around with a napkin. And just after a while going, I wonder how many people are just being like, is he just going to do this the whole time? You know, the thing that Gaffigan does with like the other voice of like, I hope he's not going to do this all the time. He was doing that back then.
Weird to see Gaffigan with red hair.
Gaffigan looked really strange in this. Clean shaven and like, well, I guess when they interviewed him, he looked more as we know him. But when he was on the podcast, that looked really weird. Like he was like leading man Gaffigan still.
The thing about this movie, the big selling point, was you get to hear Gottfried's normal voice.
Yes.
It's just him not shouting.
Right.
Take the voice you know and imagine him not shouting, and that's his normal voice. Because that's all
You
he does
hear.
on stage is he
He
shouts.
doesn't do the shouting on SNL either. They had no
Okay.
idea what to do with him when he was on SNL.
Speaking of his voice, when I heard Whoopi Goldberg before she was on camera, I thought it was Gilbert, because they have very similar voices.
Huh. And man, how uneasy was that during the tsunami stuff where she was like, this was not my joke. I am
Yeah.
reading this. Just like, don't shoot me.
The thing the movie really brings home is the man had just a heartbreaking amount of imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Well, just the stuff with his father. You know, just that whole relationship where they're talking about, they refer to it as torture, and that's even by like 70 standards. You know, how horrible must that have been?
But he just had absolutely no faith in himself, even at the height of his career.
Yeah.
I also think I've heard about him being sheep before. Like, that wasn't news to me.
Kind of. Yeah, you know, Stern would joke about it.
Okay, that's probably where I heard that then.
But nothing about the hoarding, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That was like a wait, what?
But he would like take sodas and snacks from like talk shows he was on from the green room and sit and shit.
That was Leto, like, yeah, he was the only guest that would just take all the sodas.
And he had like a box or like a little packet of cookies or crackers or something that he said, like, yeah, I got this from like a green room somewhere. Now, I shouldn't have laughed at the Catherine Zeta-Jones jokes, but I did.
Of course I did. And you know why? It was a form of muscular dystrophy that killed him.
That's the thing.
Where was Catherine Zeta-Jones at the time of his death?
Damn.
He probably knew he had it too.
Oh, my theory is that he did this movie because he knew he wasn't going to be around much longer.
Yeah.
And he just
Well, I
wanted to
think
finally open up to the world.
the interviews I've heard about it was the filmmaker really wanted to do it, and he was like, "You're gonna do a film about me, you know?"
Like, I think he agreed to it because, you know, he knew he didn't have much time left and he
Like
just.
the filmmaker was like, "Yeah, it's been my dr lifelong dream to do one about you," and he's like, "You should, you know, aim a little higher, maybe, like a Yakov
And
Smirnoff first."
God, my shell. I think the filmmaker was more of a fan than a filmmaker.
Yes, I think so too. It totally shows.
This does not have a clear narrative at
No,
all.
it doesn't. It is all over the place.
The closest comparison I can do from, you know, the movies we've done is the Lemmy documentary.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, a behind the scenes effectively on this you know, iconic controversial character following their day-to-day life. That had a clear narrative. You know, there was a clear story being told there. This was just fan service.
I think what makes this interesting, though, is some of the shit he caught.
Oh yeah. But just to go back to the Catherine Zeta-Jones jokes, just to
Yeah.
explain, he was talking about how he would be willing to get cancer in order to go down on Catherine Zeta-Jones. I, of all people, given what I've been through, my mother had cancer a couple of years ago. I shouldn't have laughed at those jokes. But the brilliance of that, and this is the brilliance of what he did, is he effectively made himself the butt of his own jokes.
Right.
He didn't in no way downplayed the horror of cancer. He just said it would be worth it.
Yes, that was the whole joke. Worth it. And some of like the stand-up just killed me though. Like him, I guess he was addressing a heckler, I'm assuming
I
here, where he's
think
like,
you're going to the exact place I am. Well,
I don't want to be here any
yes,
more than you do.
that's the next fucking thing in my notes. That killed me. I just want to get this over. We can get out of here.
Like, what was it when they interviewed, like, you know, it was, I think it was Gaffigan about, you know, like doing a great job and, you know, pleasing the audience and stuff, and Gilbert was like, my fantasy is the club owner comes back and said, oh, there was a terrible fire, but here's your check for the gig. You can go home now.
I completely relate to that. Despite being, you know, a musician, I really don't like performing. You know, if I was, you know, scheduled for a show and like was told like at the last minute, oh, you don't have to go on, oh, that would be such a relief.
But he says all this, but he's also like, you know, hawking merch
Oh
with
yeah.
at his age, you know, at his point in his career, the
He's
chance.
hawking, as it was pointed out, DVDs at a time when nobody has a DVD player.
And the funny thing is, I don't think I remember him being, I don't remember him staying after the gig at the castle. That would have been kind of cool to have seen. it was like Winkleman's or something at the time, you know, like changed from the castle to that. But that's a Jersey Shore thing.
The whole thing with the military convention was just weird.
That was insane. That was absolutely insane. And St. Charles is such a weird little place too. Oh. I've been out briefly.
I was wondering, because it's in Chicago. He was playing some venue in Chicago. I was wondering if you were familiar with it.
There's a band I'm a fan of that was trying to tell us that they're playing Chicago, but they were actually playing St. Charles, which it's like an hour away from here. It's like, come on, motherfuckers. You're not playing Chicago.
But there's this one guy, he's a military collector, who said, and I quote, "The Germans lost the war, but they won the fashion show."
And you didn't think that was a good intro.
Saying this to Gilbert Gottfried.
But the scene where he's out looking out the window at the guy in the Nazi, you know, officer uniform, and just being like, "Can you believe that?" And then turning around to seeing a
cosplaying Nazi walking up and like asking him for his autograph,
standing right behind him when he turns around. That like. I wish he'd caught a little bit more of his reaction, but you saw enough of his reaction to see, like, holy shit.
Yeah.
And just that whole scene, and Gilbert's nice to him and everything, and just, but so goddamn funny when he finally lays a joke on him at the end. Mm-hmm. When he apologizes for the uniform, tells him that, it's, you know, it's not wrinkled or anything, it's in good shape.
Missing the point.
That's the second worst thing today. The guy just looking like, what?
I did enjoy seeing a Night Court clip.
Right. I wonder if that was before or after the Beverly Hills Cop. I don't know.
Probably before. Also liked seeing him interact with Arsenio Hall. Always like seeing them play off of each
other. That scene was fantastic. In fact, he was goading Arsenio. That's the scene that really reminded me more of like the whole Chris Rock, Will Smith thing.
Yeah.
The reaction that Gilbert gave Arsenio when Arsenio threw the water on him. Gilbert, I don't think I'd seen him happier at any part of this film than that moment. He just loved that he pissed Arsenio off so much that he threw his water at him.
He was all about getting a reaction. And I loved Arsenio's line. You know, when you're working with Gilbert, you don't have to worry about the spontaneity or the danger of the moment. He'll give that to you.
He didn't need to write, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, he used a lot of the same jokes for years.
But
and a lot of them are very old jokes.
The thing I love... The thing, this turned me into a Gilbert Gottfried fan.
Really?
Because there's something he does that I do a lot, particularly when I joke about my disability. It's laugh, you cowards. I was playing Elder Scrolls Online last night, wandering around some, you know, castle looking for a flight of stairs, and the absurdity of that dawned on me in the moment. So I tweeted, you know, something along the lines of, like, the weirdest thing about playing MMOs or any number of other games as a lifelong wheelchair user is when I find myself actively looking for a flight of stairs.
Longing for a flight of stairs.
And it was kind of like I was waiting to see if anybody would laugh. I like periodically joking about it in ways that I know will make... It's basically a way to tell, to gauge someone's reaction to it. But... in Gilbert's case, it is a lot of laugh, you cowards. I dare you to laugh at that joke.
Yeah, a lot of his stuff is just delivery, of course. You know, it isn't just the shouting necessarily. It's just that,
well, that was just lingering, a trip shot.
That lingering on details, you know, that like the boy getting the blowjob joke. I think I heard that joke when I was like 6 or 7 years old. Somebody told me that, like, on a playground somewhere. That's how old that joke is. But the fact that he would go off of, like, see, he's the boy's got from his mouth. Just like the whole explaining that joke to the already offended audience members.
And now that I've seen him do it, I know where you got it from. Because you do the same thing a lot.
Yeah, it's I don't know if I got it from him or not. I mean, it's it is just always something interesting to do, you know, to tell a bad joke and then to like break it down and deconstruct
explain why it's a bad joke, yeah,
and give it far more attention than it should. I mean, to me, that's always been funny.
But the thing that gets me, he opened up to the world, perhaps maybe because he thought he knew he was dying. And it just ended up making him even more enigmatic.
Yeah. Yeah, like, my God. The real climax of this movie, of course. That St. Jude's thing.
I was terrified.
So many emotions in one scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to feel... to go through that scene. It's just, he
was booked at a benefit for St. Jude's Children's Cancer Hospital.
After the tsunami joke, too, by the way.
Yeah, after the tsunami joke.
Because
that was, I checked, that was in 2011.
Yeah.
Because what got me was he lost the gig, but there was never any talk of canceling him or any kind of major public backlash on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I realized... that sort of thing didn't really happen until, like, November 2016. Anyway, he's booked at this benefit for St. Jude's, and the father of one of their patients is up there telling him this heartbreak. Well, very emotional, because I think his kid ended up being okay. He wouldn't have been speaking there if they didn't recover. So he's telling this really emotional story about his you know, kid going through the treatment and being treated at St. Jude's and, you know, I'm assuming healed. And then Gilbert has to perform.
Well, right. You're thinking he's not actually... at first is like he's not actually going to perform at this thing, right? He's just there to...
yeah, to make an appearance.
And then you're kind of like, wait a minute, you know, he's going to. Why else would they be, like... showing this in the documentary. So then you get like this feeling of terror.
Oh shit.
This is gonna be a fucking train wreck. What's he gonna do? Like, is he gonna do the napkin bit? You know, what the hell? Is he just gonna do these terrible too soon jokes? And then he kills.
And he didn't hold back.
Yes, he wasn't clean either.
No. And then we get to the part, and I think Gilbert would be proud of me for pointing this out, about how, you know, he's concerned that his daughter will be, you know, very attractive when she gets older, and, you know, there'll be all these boys after her. He didn't have to worry about that. I think Gilbert would be proud of that joke.
Yeah, you know, I was kind of thinking that too, though. Like, oh, what do you have to worry about?
No sequels or remakes, obviously. On the brains?
On the brains.
All due respect to Gilbert, like I said, this turned me into a fan. The man was a genius. But the movie just... there was not enough material for an hour and a half. It had no narrative. I'm going 3.5.
Which is strange. I think there's... there was more material they could have done. They didn't need to, you know, go the weird route that they did with his career. You know, he was on a show, an early talk show called Thick of the Night.
Oh, God.
Like Alan Thicke.
Yes, I remember
Growing
it.
Pains.
Mm-hmm.
Another show that, I mean, they say it was ahead of its time, but, I mean, Letterman was already doing some of this stuff first.
Right.
But it was also like, the place where the Red Hot Chili Peppers made their television debut. I mean, it's like...
kind of interesting.
Insane stuff. So there's easily, you know, things like that in SNL. The story of that SNL season could, of course, be a documentary in itself.
They could have easily turned 20 minutes of it into that, and it would have been interesting.
Yeah, like he gets... I mean, think about it. He's just a stand-up in New York just doing open mics to suddenly being on SNL with, you know, Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why Eddie Murphy, you know.
So I put him in Beverly Hills Cop 2.
And that was kind of surprising, too, that press conference where Eddie Murphy was just giving so much praise to him. And Eddie Murphy is like the biggest comedian in the world at the time. Like ridiculous stadiums, you know, pre-Andrew Dice Clay. And I think pre-Kinison, too.
He invented performing in a leather jumpsuit.
Well, right. So, yeah, there was material they could have used to have made a story, you know, go. However, though, they caught such fantastic things and so much emotion. I think the price of admission alone for that Nazi thing, and then the picture of him at the end giving the salute and everything in the middle of the whole crazy thing, and the St. Jude's thing. I'm going 4.5.
All right. And what have we learned?
How the fuck has Artie Lang and Dick Van Dyke outlived all of these people?
Yeah, I was thinking the same.
Artie Lang's nose is barely intact in this still.
Yeah, he just looks off. And I learned how to tell the aristocrats. And that's it for Gilbert. Until next time, when we'll be reviewing The Suicide Squad, the new one, the James Gunn one, not that horrible previous one, kicking off a comic book two-parter. Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
This is a waste of bandwidth, this zombie takeout. Oh, here it goes.
Forgot to move my mic closer.
Should I redo that?
No. Yeah, go ahead.